Why are people successful? Can we predict how well a stock will perform? Which line will move faster at the grocery store? Is it based on ability or just good luck? Well, according to scientist and author Leonard Mlodinow, we have a lot less control over our lives than we think we do. His latest book, The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, takes a look at how randomness and uncertainty cause us to misinterpret events. It's published by Pantheon, and I'm delighted that it has brought Leonard Mlodinow back to the show today. Hi.
Hey, great.
So let's get right to it. Is success in business or love due to luck or ability?
Well, success in anything is due to both. And the issue is that quite often people underestimate the influence of random or unpredictable or uncontrollable factors, and they assume that it's due only to their planning or their abilities.
So, and that leads us to make more mistakes in our lives?
Oh, yes. In fact, in 2002, the Nobel Prize in Economics was given out to a psychologist who studied this. Back in the 70s, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, two psychologists, started studying how people evaluate situations that involve uncertainty or randomness, and they found that people make a lot of systematic errors, and that is so important in financial decisions that it led eventually to the Nobel Prize.
Well, your background is in physics, and the uncertainty principle is a basis of quantum mechanics, which is your field. Is that what got you thinking about this?
Well, it's funny. Originally, I was thinking I wanted to write a book about entropy. This is probably not something that sounds extremely exciting to
depressing.
Write people.
Yeah. More depressing than anything.
Well, I don't think it's depressing, but it's to me, the idea that things tend toward disorder was an interesting idea to look at in the real world. But around the time I was looking at that, that the prize was given out, the Nobel Prize, and I started thinking that I should broaden my scope from just thinking about entropy just to thinking about randomness in general and how it affects things in the real world. And I found that, true enough, not only other people, but I myself make mistakes in my judgments about life and my decisions based on these intuitive misunderstandings, not necessarily academic or intellectual misunderstandings, but deep-seated intuitive misunderstandings.
But even looking at your personal life, wouldn't you see luck and chance and randomness as having played a role? I mean, your parents were Holocaust survivors, and you once told me that it was almost a fluke that you ended up at Caltech, that you had read Richard Feynman when you were working in a kibbutz, and later you were able to have deep discussions with him at Caltech.
Yes, my getting to Caltech and my getting to even into physics was somewhat of a fluke because I was originally interested in math and chemistry, and I was on a kibbutz in Israel, and I found his Feynman lectures on physics, and that's what got me interested in physics. But I mean, I think the point is that most people in their lives, if they look back at their direction, where they ended up, and the major events in their lives, they will find seemingly minor events that had a major impact on their direction. And so in Drunkard's Walk, I talk about Bill Gates and Bruce Willis and people that everybody know, and I analyze their lives and show how small perturbations in their direction had huge effects on their lives.
Let's go back to whether it's skill or luck that determines success. For example, if you were interviewing someone for a job, how much weight would you put on their prior success?
Well, that's a good question. And in mathematics, we have a theorem called the law of large numbers. And what that says is that if someone has, well, I'll translate it somewhat to everyday life, but if someone has a certain probability of success at any given endeavor, then in the long run, if they try long enough, then that probability will be reflected in their results. So if they have a 60% chance, if you run a company and you have a 60% chance, let's say, of having a good year in any given year, if you look at them for a million or a zillion years, then the chances are very high that they will have close to 60% good years. That's called the law of large numbers. Now, Kahneman and Tversky coined a term called the law of small numbers, which is a bad term in a way because it's not a law. It's a sarcastic term. It's for the mistaken conception that the law of large numbers applies to small numbers. So if you look at someone who has a 60% chance of success in a given year and you're only looking at their last 5 years, the chances are 2 out of 3 that those 5 years will not reflect that 60% chance. If it did reflect them, that chance, then in 5 years the person would have 3 good years. But the chances are 2 out of 3 that they would have not 3 good years, 2 or 4 or 5. In fact, the chances in this case are 1 out of 10 that they would have had 5 good or 5 bad years in a row. So if you look at, say, the Fortune 500, and if every company was identical and had an identical 60% chance of success, and you looked at their record over 5 years, you'd find 50 of those companies with 5 good years or bad years in a row. And of course, the CEOs or whoever's in charge will be credited or blamed for that. And when people come and you're conducting a job interview and you're looking at their record, you naturally assume that if you see that they had 3 chances or 3 initiatives that they led and 2 or 1 or none or 3 were successful, that you can interpret that as reflecting their true ability. And the point is that you really can't. So what you have to do in all cases is to look beyond these small numbers of statistics and look at the person's true abilities, look at their education, talk to them, ask them questions, see how they answer the questions. Use your head a little bit and not just rely on statistics.
Although sometimes it takes a bunch of failures for somebody to figure it out. And so maybe that last year where everything just took off was the more important year to look at.
That can happen too. So you really
have to. So there are no rules here.
Well, the main rule is that results do not reflect abilities or the underlying probabilities.
Well, you say that the problem is that we are wired to look for cause and effect. So what we're always seeing patterns, we're always seeing, well, this is because of that, even though in many cases that's not the case.
Yes, people have a natural tendency to look for patterns, and it's something that psychologists believe have evolved and caused some kind of evolutionary advantage. But there's one interesting experiment I talk about in the book where people are subjected to a game called probability guessing. And that's a game where you see a series of red or green lights. And they flash without a pattern except that one of them is more prevalent than the other. Let's say the green lights come up 60% of the time. If you put a rat in front of the game and you arrange it similarly, and the rat has to choose and gets a reward if the rat chooses right, the rat will notice that, say, the green light is more prevalent, and eventually will just start pressing guessing green every time. Mm-hmm. Humans don't behave that way. If you put a
person, the
rats are smarter than humans. We get outperformed by a rat. But what we do is a person is put in front of these lights, and after a while, the experimenter says, "Now start guessing." The person will have noticed the same thing that the rat notices, but the person will tune their guesses to 60% of the time they'll guess green and 40% they'll guess red, as if they can actually find the pattern.
It also leads people to watch a baseball game and see that a guy is 0-for-3 and say, well, he's due.
That's right, and that's not true. And actually, if you're, say, a 250 hitter, the chances are great that you will not be 1-for-4 that day. In other words, 250. The chances are much higher that you'll be something other than that.
My guest is Leonard Mlodinow, whose latest book is The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. It's published by Pantheon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So why have you called your book The Drunkard's Walk?
Well, The Drunkard's Walk is a term, a mathematical term, for a process of random meandering. It's sometimes also called, somewhat less colorfully, The Random Walk. I thought, however, that a book named The Random Walk might not be as enticing as a book named The Drunkard's Walk. But The Drunkard's Walk is a very pictorial description because it really describes the way a person might move at random. And the reason that people's lives develop randomly to some extent is that they are constantly impacted by unforeseen factors. And it's those factors and the reaction to them that help determine the role in life. So I thought that was a good metaphor for the book and for the way it talks about the effects of randomness in our lives.
Well, I gave the commencement address at Brooklyn College this year, and this was pretty much the basis of my speech, which is, do not assume that what you majored in will determine what you do the rest of your life. And I gave my life as an example where I started off doing one thing and then something happened and I went up somewhere else and one day a telephone call came and somebody asked me if I wanted to do a radio show, and for a lark, I did a radio show, and then somebody asked me, well, would you like to try your hand at talk shows? And so I did that, and here I am, totally surprised that this is my career when I thought I was going to be a painter.
That is interesting. Well, one of the lessons of the book is to seize your opportunities, and it looks like you did that, and be prepared for them so that when these chances come and you're open to them, they'll take you into directions that really work out for you.
Well, how does that work for you? Because we talked about you being involved with quantum mechanics and going to Caltech, and it looked to me like you were set for a career in science. And then I find out you wrote TV shows for Hunter, for MacGyver, Night Court, Star Trek, The Next Generation. What happened? Did pop culture suddenly ruin your life?
Well, I think my career seems to have had parallels with yours, and even with Bill Gates in a way, which is that...
Except neither of us are as rich.
Well, it depends on how you define the term rich, but we don't have the same income, that's for sure. When I went to Caltech, I had always been interested in writing, and I said to myself, here I am in Los Angeles, I'm going to write a screenplay, because I love film. And that screenplay got some attention, and one thing led to another. And I described that a little bit in Feynman's Rainbow, the book about my time at Caltech. And I eventually realized that, you know, I had an opportunity. I really loved that, and I should put physics aside for a while. I never planned to leave it, but to pursue the writing career. And things miraculously worked out, and I wrote for all those television series. But, I also didn't write for film, so I never quite went in the direction I wanted to originally. And it was fun writing for television, but ultimately the reason I left television was that I really had wanted to write for film, and I got a little tired of television.
Is it true that you were almost broke when you sold your first script?
Yes, it is. In fact, I wasn't going to be able to pay the rent, and then out of the blue came a phone call.
Is it possible to leave physics and then go back to it?
It's difficult, but I have managed over the years to, every few years, to write a paper. You have to... pick a subfield of physics that's not moving maybe quite as fast as the as particle theory that I was in when I started, but you can do it, and I think history shows that there are a lot of very good amateur mathematicians and scientists over the years.
Well, you seem to be the only physicist who's not thinking about string theory.
Well, I do think about string theory, but I don't engage in it.
You keep on mentioning Bill Gates and what happened to him. What happened to him?
Well, Bill Gates in the early 80s was a computer entrepreneur. And I should back up and say the reason I decided to examine Bill Gates was I was watching the Daily Show one evening, and he came on the show. And normally, Jon Stewart is somewhat sarcastic and funny, and the audience and the whole show is far from reverential. And suddenly I noticed a change in tone when Bill Gates was coming on. And, of course, since Bill Gates was the richest man in the world for many years and, is widely admired and thought to be a deity, I guess I could understand that their attitude. But they treated him, I thought, very gently. And he started asking him questions about the future of the Internet and computer industry. And I worked in that industry for a little while myself, and I was wondering if his answers would be extremely impressive or just ordinary, and I found that they were somewhat ordinary. And that got me to thinking, well, is he a god, viewed as a god because he's done so well, or does he done so well because he's viewed as a god, or what's behind this? And I looked into his history, and I found that there were quite a few computer entrepreneurs in the early 80s, and he had the good fortune that a fellow from IBM came to see him about an operating system when they were coming up with their PC. And nobody thought that it would be anything like it turned into today, and Bill Gates didn't have an operating system. He sent him to someone else. And fortunately for Bill Gates, that person didn't get on with the IBM people, and they came back to him. And then he said, well, I know somebody else who could have one. And they kind of decided, should we IBM get it, or you want to get it for us? And it was not something that it was not the result of great planning or genius. It happened that Bill Gates went for it and that IBM decided to license it from him rather than buy it outright. And that was, of course, DOS. And, the rest is history. But it
ruined the world from that moment on.
Well, some would say that. I won't get into that part. But the point is that Bill Gates is obviously a quite capable and good and aggressive businessman. But there were many others. There's a whole ensemble of people that sort of thing could have happened to, and who some would have maybe not been quite as successful as him. Some may have been more successful. But he had the lucky break, and he did with it what he did. But that doesn't mean that he may be head and shoulders above the other entrepreneurs of his time in the money that he's made, but not necessarily in his ability.
I'm more interested in what this tells us about Jon Stewart, but that's a whole other matter. Leonard Mlodinow's book is called The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, and it's published by Pantheon. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. I'm speaking with Leonard Mlodinow, who has a doctorate in physics from the University of California, Berkeley, was an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the Max Planck Institute, and now teaches about randomness to future scientists at Caltech. We mentioned his TV career, and there have been a number of books, one of which brought him here before, and now he's back with The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. It's published by Pantheon. So let's talk about randomness in business and investing. Can mutual fund managers predict whether their investments will pan out?
Well, there's a big debate on what extent they might be able to predict. Some say that stocks move in a random walk, and that as soon as any information is available, it's been absorbed into the stock market, and you have no ability to beat the market. Other people say that there is a tiny ability if you work hard enough to get a small edge. I don't know anyone who says you could get a larger edge, but I find that when you look at the media world and the way that people talk about the stock market, all those facts are ignored, and people do proclaim or pretend that they can beat the market, that they do beat the market. And of course, some people do beat the market, but my point in the book is that those people who beat the market are probably doing it due to good luck. And I can give you an example.
You mean Warren Buffett is just lucky?
Well, I didn't study Warren Buffett in detail. I did study a fellow named Bill Miller, who is probably well known out here in New York. His mutual fund beat the Standard & Poor's Index for 15 years in a row.
That's a big number.
That's a big number. And he was called a genius, and for all I know, he may be a genius. I can't comment on that, but I can comment on the interpretation of his success as being due to genius. When you're in science, when you see an effect happening, before you believe that the effect is happening according to your pet theory, you always compare the chances of that could have happened by randomness alone. And so if you do that with this streak, at first it sounds like the streak is extremely extraordinary. If you assume that he was just flipping coins and that he had a 50-50 chance in each year of beating the Standard & Poor's, then the chances of beating the Standard & Poor's for a given 15-year period is about 1 in 30,000. There were articles written that said it was much, much lower than that, 1 in 100,000, 1 in a million, 1 in a billion, but it's about 1 in 30,000. But in the realm of randomness, you have to be very careful what question you ask. And what is really impressing us about this streak, it's not that it was a streak for the period from 1991, I think it was, till 2006. It could have started in 89 or 88 or 95. Well, we wouldn't be there yet, but it could have started in another year. It would be just as impressive. So all those opportunities to start the streak are going by, and you have to take those into account. Also, it didn't impress us that specifically Bill Miller achieved this streak. Anybody who had achieved the streak would have been equally deified and written about and glorified and rich and well-known. So it's not really fair to pick out and say, what are the chances that a specific person would do this? There are about 5,000 or 6,000 mutual fund managers, and they're all trying to do it. So I took factors like this into account, and I did a calculation. I said, what are the chances that if all mutual fund managers were flipping or simply flipping a coin, and if they got heads, they beat the Standard & Poor's, and if they got tails, they didn't. What are the chances that some one of them would have a streak of 15 or more years at some time in the era of modern mutual funds? And so I said, suppose there's 1,000. I wanted to be conservative, 1,000 managers. And I took a period of 40 years, which I took that period because one of the articles about him called this the greatest feat in the last 40 years. And that's not such a long period because, after all, you can't even fit three of these streaks in that period. But I did a calculation, and I said, what are the chances that if this was the case, that at least one of these managers would have a streak of 15 or more years in that period? And it came out surprisingly to be 2/3. So I think that the headline that says Bill Miller beats Standard & Poor's 15 years in a row, he's a genius, should be replaced by a headline, expected 15-year streak finally occurs, Bill Miller, lucky beneficiary.
Well, it's interesting. We keep on reading stories along these lines. For example, I remember many years ago reading a thing in the paper about how somebody just threw darts at at stock market reports and then invested theoretically in the companies that he'd hit and did better than Standard & Poor's.
Well, of course, you can do better, you can do worse, but
for me because I'm such a bad darts player. But
that's right. Well, maybe it's better playing ping pong. Actually, there was a fellow that I talk about in the book who predicted whether the market would go up or down each year and had an enormous success rate. I think he predicted it correctly for 18 out of 19 years. And his method was something like that. He based it on who won the Super Bowl. His name was Leonard Coppett. And so streaks like that, of course, by chance can work.
So does that mean all mutual funds are equal? We just luck out and get one that has a good streak? Or we have bad luck and lose some money?
Well, I have an interesting graph in the book where I took the top 800 mutual funds and I ranked them from 1 to 800. And on the vertical axis, I showed their average rate of return. And, of course, the number one had the highest. And it kind of smoothly, in a very nice curve, went down from as you went to the right from number one to number 800. The curve went down. And the question is, and, of course, most people base their purchases on the past history of the past 3 or 5 years. And the question is that right? Does the past reflect the future? People have a tendency to feel that it does. But then I made another graph, and I took those same funds, it kept the ranking the same, but now graph their success over the next 5 years. And if there were a causal relationship and if their past 5 years meant something, then you expect the graph to look the same over the next 5 years.
Or similar enough.
And instead, it pretty much looked like random noise. And so this told me that the premium you're paying for a mutual fund that's had a good history, like Bill Miller's or other mutual funds, is not worth it. You should buy an index fund because you're paying quite a bit and you're not getting it back.
My guest is Leonard Mlodinow, Mlodinow. His book, The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, is published by Pantheon. Where does chaos theory come into this? Because you write about the butterfly effect, which I always associated with chaos.
And that is the one area where I do touch on chaos theory. And the butterfly effect comes from the idea that a butterfly flapping its wings somewhere over the ocean could cause sometime later, you know, a hurricane in let's say, the Gulf of Mexico because of
a drop drops.
It has to do with instability, so that a small change in initial conditions can cause a large change in the outcomes. And that's one of the tenets of chaos theory. And in our lives, that, as you discussed earlier and I alluded to in my life, you can have small changes. I was going to a mailbox once to mail a letter turning down a fellowship to Germany before I went there my first time. And on the way there, I bumped into the lady from the fellowship office at Berkeley, where I was a graduate student. And she said, "Oh, hey, how are you doing? I heard you got the fellowship. Congratulations." And I said, "No, I'm just about to mail this to turn it down." And she convinced me to talk to my advisor about it first. And I ended up taking it, and it changed my life in a big way. Had she been 10 steps ahead or behind where she ended up, my life would have changed in a great way. You know, it would have been very different. So this is the butterfly effect in your life.
Weren't you at the World Trade Center in 9/11?
Yes, I was.
Because we hear a lot of butterfly effect type stories there. I've had friends that told me, well, you know, in fact, a famous chef was supposed to be working at the Windows of the World. But he had to get his eyeglass. He had to get new eyeglasses. He was downstairs, and otherwise he would have been up there doing breakfast and would have died. Other people have said, you know, my kid was sick, so I had to stay home or take him to school. I arrived late, whatever. And they're really describing the butterfly effect, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And
people do understand randomness, but they don't understand way.
Well, this is just one of the aspects of randomness. But I found that most people don't. I mean, obviously, in that case, it's pretty obvious to people. But I think people often don't examine their lives that closely to see how something really tiny has caused a major change.
What role does expectation play in all of this, in our relationship with randomness?
Well, one of the ways that we misjudge randomness is that we expect things to happen in certain ways. If we see Bill Miller is running the mutual fund and he's at the head of it and he has a great credentials, we expect, of course, that he has these abilities. And so when we make our judgments about people and things, we are very influenced by expectations. For instance, in the wine arena, there have been studies done where wine experts have been given different wines to judge. And unbeknownst to them, white wines have been dyed to look like red wines. And when they take notes on the wines, they attribute to the white wines things that are qualities that are normally in red wines. And people who prefer Coke and Pepsi, there have been tests done where people who prefer Coke are given Coke and Pepsi, and they pick the Coke, and the Pepsi people pick the Pepsi, but the experimenter had switched the bottles, so they were really picking the wrong one. And quite often people judge events according to their expectations, and that's one of the reasons that we make mistakes. And people also tend to believe that they can control things much more than they really can. So when you're looking at a Bill Miller, not only do you expect him to be good, but you have an innate tendency to feel that he must be able to control his destiny, or that you must be able to control your destiny. So that's another bias that people have. There's a great study of Yale University students who were asked to predict coin tosses. And again, the experimenter cheated, and they weren't really told their successes. They were told that when they predicted the coin toss, what they were told, whether they got it right or wrong, depended on a pre-existing sequence that the experimenter had worked out. So they were each guaranteed to have 15 successes and 15 failures. After this, now you would, if you asked a Yale student, can you predict coin tosses or control them, obviously they would say no. But after this experiment, they were given slightly more subtle questions, like, would you have done better if you had practiced? It's only slightly more subtle. Or would you have done worse with distraction? And a significant number answered as if they would do better with practice or worse with distraction, as if they actually had some control or some ability to foresee things. And this is a deep-seated feeling that people have, an emotional feeling that they can control the world around them.
What role does the placebo effect play in all of this? For example, when we get a specialty cream and assume that it's going to work a lot better than the cheap stuff at the local drugstore, and it does seem to.
Right, because people do judge events according to their expectations. So if you feel that it's going to work, I mean, there was a study done that placebos that are said to be more expensive work better than placebos that are said to be less expensive, because people expect
even on the
placebo level. And there was the same study was done at Caltech, actually, with wines. It was great. They put a series of wines in front of students, and one among the wines was one bottle, a $90 bottle, all the prices were given for the wines, but this wine was given twice, and once marked as $90 and once as $10. And when they tasted them, and of course you say, of course the students picked the $90 bottle as being better. But the punchline here is that they weren't just sitting at a table tasting these wines. These students were in MRI machines, and the experimenter was watching whether what part of the brains lit up, and they found the pleasure center of the brain really did light up more when they were tasting the identical wine as labeled $90 than when it was labeled $10. So we actually do enjoy it more when we think that it's more expensive.
Let's talk a bit about sports. I mean, there are athletes who are consistent, and there are athletes who, I mean, they're consistent
sure.
Positively and negatively.
And I want to emphasize that I'm not saying that ability doesn't matter. Ability does matter. I'm just saying that your results don't always reflect exactly your ability. So a better hitter will consistently do better, but not every year.
And not every at-bat. I was just thinking and reading your book about watching a Mets game the other day, and they had this the batter came up and they showed the statistic that when there are men in scoring position with two out, he tends to hit very well. It's something like a .750 batting average. And then he grounded into a double play.
Well, actually, people have studied sports quite extensively because the statistics are available. And they have found that there's no such streaks or records in sports that aren't predicted by a purely random model. If you input people's ability, then the extraordinary feats that they achieve occur just as you would expect. So, for instance, Roger Maris is an example. He was a 40-ish home run hitter who hit 60 home runs. You know, people blame him for having only one good year and say that psychologically he couldn't handle the stress. But if you do a calculation, you'll find that over all the years of all the 40-ish home run hitters, and you look at the fluctuations in that, it was expected that at some point somebody who was a 40-ish home run hitter would have a spike of 60.
It also helped that he batted before Mickey Mantle.
A lot of things helped.
But that was good pitchers.
Of course, well, some people say 1961 was magic because a lot of people hit home runs. There's a lot of things you could say, but these are all somewhat random things that played into his career and helped him have that spike.
So what happens in the Olympics? Don't most of the people who are favored to win because of ability?
I don't know if most people who are favored to win, but
ability, the fastest person generally wins.
If Roger Maris was a 20 home run hitter, he would not have had that streak. The fact that he was a 40-ish home run hitter is why he was in the class of people who might have that streak. And if Mickey Mantle was a 50-ish home run hitter, he was probably more likely to have that home run record, but he didn't. And you know, the faster people usually win, but not always. And if you look at, for instance, if you look at the baseball World Series, I did a calculation, and you assume that, let's say that the Yankees are playing the Cubs, since I'm from Chicago,
and the Cubs are due, God
And the
knows.
Cubs are due. Of course, we all know the Cubs are a good example. They've been better every year at the last 100 and never won. It's just pure bad luck. But suppose that the Yankees were better, and let's suppose that they were 55 over 45 favorites, right? That means that in the long run, the law of large numbers tells us that they would win about 55% of the time. But you might ask, in a seven-game series, how often will the inferior Cubs win? And the answer comes out to be 40% of the time. And then if you want to be a scientist and you want to minimize that to where the lesser team wins less than 5% of the time, less than once in 20, guess how long a series you'd have to play to be that to have that guaranteed? 269 games. And that's why sports isn't a science and fluctuations happen.
And that's why the Patriots didn't win the Super Bowl.
There are people who argue with that, but okay.
won't knowing how little control we have cause some people to just give up?
Well, I think the contrary. What it means is that it means, on the one hand, when you have a success, don't get a big head and be a jerk about it. And on the other hand, when you have failures, don't take them to heart. And as a writer, there are many examples of multiple failures. And Harry Potter was rejected 9 times.
John Grisham's. Book.
And people, you know, the manuscripts were great and the people were successes.
Well, it's been my experience that half the people who really succeed well think it's because they're brilliant, and the other half think it's because they're imposters and they've gotten away with something.
Yeah, that's true, too.
In the end, it's probably luck and ability that got them to where they are. At least that's the message of your book.
Well, I like Thomas Watson's quote, if you want to succeed, double your failure rate.
Leonard Mlodinow's book, The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, is published by Pantheon. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again, and good luck with your new screenplay.
Well, thanks. It's been fun to see you again, too.